Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Edmund White, whose latest book is titled Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris. Edmund White is the author of 25 earlier books, including City Boy, My Life in New York During the 60s and 70s, Jack Holmes and His Friend, which was the most recent novel, A Boy's Own Story, Farewell Symphony, many other books. Most of these novels are autobiographical, and the memoirs are, of course, autobiographical. Edmund White has, after writing all of the autobiographical novels, chose to write City Boy, which was a memoir about his years in New York, and then has followed it up now with his years in Paris, which began in 1983 and lasted pretty much to the end of the century, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I think about 15, 16 years altogether.
You made a decision in writing it not to make it chronological, but to kind of let it wander almost in a Proustian way. Was that deliberate?
I wrote it when I was in the hospital, and I couldn't walk or talk, but I could still scribble, though nobody could read my writing. So it was fairly stream of consciousness, I guess, although I rewrote it quite a bit. It was edited more than any of my other books have been. And usually I just write one draft and that's it. But this one I rewrote several times, not so much to improve the language as to make it somewhat better structured.
You were in the hospital with a major stroke.
Yeah. I had a stroke and I couldn't walk or talk, and I was in rehab for a month. It was pretty grim, and I still walk with a cane, and I don't really have trouble talking, but somewhat.
But you have no trouble writing.
No, I mean, my stroke was in the pons, which controls things like swallowing and peeing and all kinds of things like that. But it doesn't affect your cognitive functions, or so we like to think.
Edmund White, when you were writing this book in the hospital and you were going through the various memories, did you have any notes to work with, or was this just off the top of your head at that point?
Yes, it was off the top of my head. I never keep diaries or notes, but now we live in the era of Google, so you can Google everybody and everything.
A lot of the book focuses on the relationship between how Americans think and French think, a little bit about the British. It seemed to me as I read the book, and I guess as you were writing it, that more and more differences became clearer to you. What do you think is the biggest difference between how the two cultures think?
I think they're very different with regards to minority groups, for instance, and political correctness. They don't really believe much in political correctness. I mean, for instance, they would roll their eyes if you said you were a gay novelist or a black novelist or a Jewish novelist. They hate all those little categories, and they want everyone to be universal. I mean, it's strange because they've had so many great gay writers, starting with Proust and going through Gide and Genet. Their number one bestseller in France I just read, which was written by a 21-year-old gay boy, which is his life story about coming out in a working-class neighborhood in the north of France and being bullied constantly for being a sissy.
He's just shown as a writer. They don't say gay or straight.
That's right, and they wouldn't do that to him. I mean, they think of that as a loss of freedom to be defined as gay or black or Jewish or whatever. It's a very different approach to things.
Do you think any of that is reflected in the language, or is it something that's reflected more in how Americans live, or coming out of, say, an English tradition, and French coming out of a different tradition?
I don't know about that, but I think that we have so many special interest groups. I mean, this was a melting pot country, and in politics we have so many lobbies. Every blasted little cause has a different lobby. It's hard to get much of a feeling of unanimity in this country about something, but in France, I think those differences are downplayed. People to the extreme right in France will say France for the French. You know, they don't like immigrants. They don't like black people or Arabs. And now they don't like gays. I mean, the French have been very militant against gay marriage. It's been passed by Parliament, so it had a majority in terms of policy, but there are still hundreds of thousands of demonstrators against gay marriage in France.
Is this new or just a visual image of what's always been there?
It's pretty new as a phenomenon. I think it shocked an awful lot of Parisians, for instance. I think it was really extreme right Catholics who were coming up in big bus loads from their local parishes to demonstrate against gay marriage. And the whole line against gay marriage is a very Catholic one, in that what they're really opposed to is adoption. The whole idea that gays might get their hands on some adopted child or some surrogate mother, whether they're lesbians or gay men. And one of their slogans is, every child deserves a mother and a father.
Pretty backward compared to what we have even in the United States.
I think America has always been very innovative about lifestyles. We're not very good about policy or politics, but we're real good about thinking up new ways to live. And San Francisco certainly is a forcing shed for that.
Edmund White, 1983, you decide to go to France to live in Paris to do some writing there. You wanted to get out of the world of AIDS in New York and try something new. When you got over there, you spoke no French. You only knew a couple of people. Gradually, it seemed like you got to know half of Paris, which is pretty extraordinary. You must have put in several hours a day just trying to figure out what the hell you were doing.
Well, I had gotten to the age of 43, and at that point, I think in your life, you can either go ahead and do what you're doing for the rest of your life, or you can start all over again. And so I thought it'd be more fun to be a student than a professor, which I had been, and more fun to just sort of invent myself in a new way. But I had been the first president of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which was still the biggest AIDS organization in the world, I think. But I thought, oh, I don't want to do this the rest of my life. I'd like to write some books. People like Larry Kramer were furious at me for abandoning the ship in the midst of the AIDS crisis. But, of course, it caught up with me very quickly in Paris, because very close friends of mine began to die, too, there. And France has had a very high rate of AIDS.
Well, at that point, how did the French hospitals deal with it?
Well, I think better than we do, because I had a lover named Hubert who died of AIDS. I was teaching briefly at Brown in America, in Rhode Island, but they didn't have health coverage for domestic partners, so we really had to go back to France. And everything in France, you know, is covered. I mean, it's probably the best national health system in the world. I mean, better than England, certainly better than Italy. I mean, they will pick you up in a taxi and take you to the hospital, and all that's free. You have all the greatest specialists. Hubert was trying a lot of experimental things, that none of which worked out, but we were seeing the leading medical professors in the world and things like that.
They were pretty much on top of it over there.
Yes. I mean, they had had a terrible mistake that they had to pay for dearly, and that was in about 83, they had a problem with contaminated blood because they refused to use the American system for screening blood to see if the blood had AIDS virus in it or not. So a lot of people, hemophiliacs, a lot of them got AIDS and died, and the French government has had to pay them and their families millions and millions of dollars.
Edmund White, you go over there, you live your life for several years, you come back here, and then, you know, eventually you catch up and you're going to write about it. As you were working on the first draft, were you able to distinguish or be careful about living people who you might know and see again versus dead people that you could more or less say anything about?
Well, I did, especially in the English chapter, write about a lot of friends and say some pretty sharp things. So I'm still kind of waiting for the fallout of that. But I went over 137 questions that the English lawyer posed, and in America the lawyers posed about 87 questions. I mean, English libel laws are a lot stricter. And I don't have a publisher in France. I think they're a little afraid of this. It's not really so scandalous, but I do say things like, I guess I out some people that wouldn't want to be outed.
For some reason, and I don't know, maybe it's just coincidence, but it seemed like everyone you met was either a diplomat, a billionaire, or an artist.
I worked for Vogue magazine, and I was writing about the cultural life in Paris, so I would interview famous dress designers like Yves Saint Laurent, Azzedine Alaïa, and I would meet filmmakers and movie stars and people like that. And, of course, writers have a lot more prestige in France than they do in America, so people like to invite writers to dinner. In England, all the writers know each other because the aristocrats can't be bothered with them.
But it also means that you got to a lot of different and strange meals with a lot of different and strange people.
Yeah, I know. I have a whole chapter, basically, on all the oddball French writers. You know, people who are pedophiles who write books with titles like Less Than 16 Years, where the guy can go to bed with either boy or girl as long as they're younger than 16. Well, I mean, I think France is getting kind of fussy about pedophilia now, but they certainly weren't in the past.
There's an article recently by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times about Holland and his two mistresses, claiming that the problem was that one of the mistresses wasn't a wife and that the French can't excuse cheating on a mistress with a mistress.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, yeah, marriages are sort of dynastic or economic, or they're designed to raise children, whereas a mistress is somebody you're supposed to be in love with, and so to cheat on a lover is the worst thing.
In working on the book, did you find any limitations in the memoir in the sense that you couldn't invent, or if the memory was a little shaky, did you kind of take a leap of faith?
You mentioned earlier that I write autobiographical novels, but to me the contract with the reader is very different in a novel and in a memoir. In the memoir, you're obliged to say the truth and nothing but the truth, and I hate the whole idea, even the words I hate, of creative nonfiction. I think that just sounds like a synonym for lying. I don't believe in being creative about your nonfiction. I mean, that is, in making stuff up at all. I think if you're writing a biography or an autobiography or history, you really have to be as faithful to the truth as you can be, as you perceive it to be. Of course, you get things wrong, but you try not to.
Did you have people you knew in France vet it for you then?
I did. I have a very good friend called René de Sicatti, who's an editor at Le Seuil and who's a wonderful novelist as well. He read through it all and found about 14 mistakes in spelling. I mean, because I never did my studies in French, so I have trouble writing in French. I write emails every day in French, but they're pretty lame.
A lot of the focus of the book winds up with a woman named Marie-Claude de Brunhoff, who I guess was kind of like your best friend.
Yes, I wanted to write about that relationship because in Jack Holmes and His Friend, I explored the relationship between a gay man and a straight man, which is something you see a lot in life. But I think you also see a lot in life gay men who are very, very close to straight women, or straight or gay, but anyway, who have a best girlfriend. And that was certainly my experience there. And it kind of provided an arc for the whole book because I met her several years before I moved to Paris. She introduced me to everybody, and she died about the time I left Paris. So it was a complete circle.
Who was she? I mean, I got the impression that this is a really fascinating, incredible woman who no one heard of except in Paris, where everyone knew who she was.
Well, she was a scout for a big French publishing house, and she would read all the new books in English and American. And she was a scout the other way for Knopf in America, reading all the new French books. Hundreds of writers and hundreds of books passed through her hands every month, and she was sort of like you. And she also had grown up in Mexico because she was Jewish, and her father very wisely got the family out of France during the Second World War, and they lived in safety in Mexico. She grew up really in Mexico, and she was as fluent in Spanish as in French or English. But she was the ex-wife of the man who wrote Babar the Elephant, who had inherited the thing from his father. His father only did 7 Babar books, and then he died quite young of TB in the late 30s. And then Laurent de Bronhoff, Mary Claude's husband, began to do the books in the 50s, and he's now done 50 of them. So most of the books you might have read of Babar were done by Laurent. About the time that I got really close with Mary Claude, and when I first started living in Paris, her husband left her for a younger American woman and is now married to her. And Mary Claude just fell apart. She was locked up in a mental hospital because she had tried to kill herself. I became very close to her and really sort of part of the family at that point in her life. It was really one of the great friendships of my life.
How old was she in relation to you?
I think she's about 7 or 8 years older.
Did you ever play beard with her?
No, I never did. She had a wonderful talent for being feminine, being even coquettish, as all French people are, flirtatious, but never coming on. You know, I've had women friends in this America where they either want to treat you like a sister or they want to treat you as a man who should be redeemed and made straight. And those two mistakes, I think, Mary Claude avoided. She never treated me as a girlfriend. I mean, I was definitely a man, and she never treated me as a boyfriend. She was perfect. She was perfect.
You say toward the end of the book that one of the problems after she died was that she would always go anywhere with you, one of those kind of people. Those kind of people are hard to come by.
They are very hard to come by, and it's one of the things I know. Like, a couple of years ago, I was crazy about going to Buenos Aires, where I've never been, and I tried to enlist various friends of mine, but everyone's too busy, or they've got their grandchildren to worry about, or something, or their jobs. Everybody works to death in America. I mean, that's a big difference between the French and the Americans. The French, I think, are wonderfully efficient and productive, but they don't kill themselves working the way we do.
Edmund White, I found a 1988 Paris Review interview. You claimed to be more neurotic when you write than when you don't, that you don't like writing, but you write because you must. Is that still true? Was that even true then?
When I write autobiographical things, I kind of relive everything, which is a very romantic idea of writing, which I don't subscribe to, but that I fall into. I wrote a novel called The Farewell Symphony about seeing lots of friends die from AIDS. That was really very painful to write. I couldn't seem to get a feeling of distance or mastery over it. I really experienced it. So in that sense, writing is painful for me. And then I'm a very insecure person. So I think that I'm always afraid of goofing up or not writing well anymore or losing my talent or whatever. And so I am quite anguished as a writer.
But on the other hand, you must write.
For money, for one thing. Because, I mean, I'm poor, relatively speaking. And, you know, people always assume that if you have 25 books, you must be making a lot of money in royalties. Well, I'll get a royalty check for A Boy's Own Story from Sweden, $6.72. That's my kind of royalties. So I have to write partly to make money, but also I enjoy writing. People say to me, why don't you retire? And I always think, writers don't retire. I mean, the great thing about writing is that it sort of ties your days together. You're involved in this big project, which can be onerous in the sense that you feel like you're carrying this very heavy stone up a hill. But on the other hand, it does constantly occupy your thoughts, and you're always thinking of some new little tidbit for your current novel.
How often do you write? You write every single day, no matter what, and if you do,
No, I'm not at all disciplined. I don't have an office. I write on the dining room table in the midst of all the other mail and everything else that's on the table. I write longhand. Then I dictate it after I finish writing it longhand. I dictate it to a secretary who puts it on the computer.
How did you write the memoir if you were stuck in a hospital?
I wrote it by hand, but in very shaky, almost illegible handwriting, because I had to learn how to write again, too. I could sort of read my scrawls. In the end, I dictated all that to a secretary, but by that point, I was out of the hospital.
One thing about all of your work is it's very elegant writing. On that first draft, is it elegant or just kind of sloppy? I did this, then I did this, then I did this.
I think that I enjoy coming up with formulas and phrases and epithets, and, you know, the Irish say you need to put a skin on everything you say. I like to do that.
Edmund White, during that period in the 80s, were you thinking at all about what was going on in America politically with gay people? For instance, in the 90s, Clinton passed DOMA, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Did you have many thoughts, or were you thinking, thank God I'm not there?
No, I did very much so, and I felt extremely isolated because, I mean, I was committed to living in France, and it was a great new project for me. But on the other hand, when I found out I was positive in 1985, I assumed that I would die in a year or two the way everybody else did. But in fact, I was what I turned out to be, as I discovered much, much later. I was a slow progressor, which means that your counts do drop. But by the time mine were really low, the cocktail of new medicines had kicked in. But anyway, I did feel very isolated and depressed when I was first diagnosed. And I felt as though with each book that I was writing for gay men in America, especially, I stayed in touch pretty well with political events in America.
I noticed looking at you that you got lucky. The early cocktails didn't affect your physical appearance.
I have been very lucky all around. I mean, it's not lucky to lose 100 of your friends, and it's not lucky to watch lovers of yours die from AIDS. But all things considered, what could have happened to me, I did get off fairly lightly.
Edmund White, the book is filled with all of these extraordinary people that you met. Who surprised you the most? Somebody who just came out of the blue and was suddenly not what you expected?
I collaborated on my Genet book with a wonderful Lebanese man called Albert Dichy, not famous. He's a straight guy who's a fantastic womanizer. I mean, he just has endless adventures. And I don't think he ever really liked other men very much. Almost all of his friends are women. But we were very close, and he remains one of my closest friends. When I was there in September, I was able to give him a medal from the French government. It was so crazy because he's Lebanese, I'm American. The formula was, in the name of the French government, I make you a knight, you know, a chevalier. And it was so cuckoo.
And what about the person who you expected to dazzle you, and instead they were bores?
Yves Saint Laurent, I do still admire his clothes and his inventiveness and everything, but he was very drugged when I met him, and he had a lot of trouble staying awake, and that was pretty disappointing and boring, I would think.
Did you ever meet the Queen?
Yes, I did. I went to her Golden Jubilee with Martin Amis, the writer. Martin was presented to the Queen because he was in the inner circle. I was in the outer circle, so I just wandered around and saw her, but I was never introduced to her exactly. Martin said to her, "You knighted my father, Your Majesty," and his father was a writer, Kingsley Amis, and she said, "I have no memory of that."
In America, we tend to think of the very rich as boring, ego-driven. Is that what it's like in France? I mean, the very rich as dull as they are here?
I remember talking to Marie-Hélène Rothschild, one of the Rothschilds who moved to America right after Mitterrand was elected because she was afraid he was going to confiscate all of her money. And she moved back within a year, and she said that what she didn't like about America was that rich people socialized with other rich people of exactly the same level of wealth, and that they didn't see amusing writers, artists, dancers, painters, and so on. Whereas in France, every hostess tries to put together a bouquet of people so that you'll have a famous actress, and then you'll have a member of the French Academy, and then you'll have a famous doctor, and so on. You can kind of see that in social scenes in Proust, and I think that definitely still went on.
Sounds like it's a good way for a struggling writer who's living paycheck to paycheck to get a lot of great meals.
That's right. Definitely. A lot of great meals. Although the cliche in France is that the rich eat badly, that they don't care about food, and that they think it's sort of more distinguished to eat badly. Whereas the lower middle class, if you want to find the best markets, food markets in France, you go to a lower middle class neighborhood, and those people spend about 25% of their wealth on food.
One area that I'd never heard of, but apparently it's the Hamptons of France, because M.C. Marie Claude had a place there, is Ile de Ré. Had you heard of it before you actually went there?
I had heard about it in France, but not here. It's true that it's a fairly closely guarded secret. Do you remember there were those two famous Chicago film critics who were on TV all the time?
Siskel and Ebert, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Siskel, we would go with him to Ile de Ré, because he liked the idea that nobody would know who he was, because TV stars aren't known at all outside of their own country, whereas movie stars are known everywhere. I think he liked it and didn't like it. If nobody notices you at all, ever, then you begin to wonder, what's up? It's true that it's an entirely different world. It's an island north of Bordeaux on the Atlantic coast that has wonderful little fishing villages, and those are mostly kind of bohemian, rich bohemian hangouts now.
Edmund White, in all of those dinners that you went to and all those people, did they talk politics? Did you suddenly, were your eyes suddenly opened by someone blurting out fascist or Nazi thought or Stalinist thought?
I never heard Stalinist thoughts, but I did hear pretty right-wing views. I think that people like us in America are almost all left-wing. You just almost never hear anything really vile or anti-Semitic. But in France, you do. Friends of your friends, people in your circle, can be fascist. I mean, they'll have a picture of Le Pen on their piano. I don't know. You meet a lot of strange people. Like, I met some royalist who would hang a black flag from their balcony every February on the day that Louis XVI was beheaded. I mean, that was still a very real thing to them.
Why do you think that's so different between France and America?
France is a very ancient culture in which they've had a lot of time to accumulate wealth. I think more French people have a second home than in any other country in the world. And it's partly because your rich uncle leaves a house, and then your aunt leaves a house, and you're like the only heir, because there were fairly small families and a low birth rate in France for a long time. So it meant that a lot of the family wealth would descend on the shoulders of one or two heirs. You meet people with historic names. You meet people who, everybody sort of seems to be related to somebody. Like Claude Picasso was a friend of mine, and he was the son of Picasso. The French are very bad at introducing him. They never say who somebody is, and then he'll be enthralling all during dinner, and then he leaves, and you say, who was that? And they'll say, oh, that was Louis Malle. You never get properly introduced, because the idea is that if you're anybody, you already know him.
And it's bad protocol to pretend that you don't or to ask, right?
Yeah, there's a lot less asking in France than in America. Like, it's considered rude to say, where are you from? Which is a standard question in America. But it makes people very uneasy in Paris, because they think maybe you've detected some substandard accent or something. Because people move only once in France. They move from the provinces to Paris, and then they spend the rest of their life in Paris. And they want to seem and come off as Parisians, and they don't want you to guess that maybe they're from Provence or
somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere.
Edmund White, now you've been back in the United States for over a decade, but you go back to France periodically. Has France changed a lot in those 10, 12, 13 years?
Yeah, I think you definitely, in Paris especially, see an awful lot of unemployed people, and young people too. And you can go to the biggest bookstore in France, Fnac, and there will be all these kind of unwashed young men sitting on the floor looking at comic books, because the French love comic books. I mean, adults read these rather gory comic books. There's a kind of shabbiness. When I first went to Paris, almost every man, let's say, on the subway would have a coat and tie on. You'd almost never see anybody not dressed up. Now, everybody looks, they're in jeans and they're sloppy, just like Americans. I think Americans assume there's been more Americanization than there has been. I mean, people do go to McDonald's, but only after the movie's late on Saturday night. Not very often. I mean, people still go to very expensive French restaurants where they spend 5 hours at the table.
Do you miss living there?
This will sound snobbish, but what I really miss is a very well-educated, intelligent people, especially intelligent readers. It seems to me that the level of education there, like, for instance, I served on several PhD candidate boards in France, you know, where you would be the judge of somebody. And those things always seemed to me, I've done the same thing in America, and it seemed to me that the level in France was much higher. I mean, for one thing, if you write a PhD thesis in France, it's 1,000 pages long. Usually you're about 40 by the time you get it.
Edmund White, what are you working on now?
I'm writing a novel about a French male fashion model who comes from France to New York in about 1980, which is the very moment when models became supermodels. I have a lot of fun looking at New York through French eyes, or pretending that I'm French. He's gay, and he discovers the whole gay world in America, and he's sort of a Dorian Gray character. He never gets older. Everybody else does. And so I have quite a few friends like that who are models, like the writer Brad Gooch, who's 65 now, and he looks 40 maximum.
From your stroke, you're now pretty much, except for the cane, pretty much recovered.
Yes, I am, I think. You know, I wrote a book about Paris called The Flaneur, which means the stroller, somebody who strolls around without any purpose. And the last time I was in Paris, which was about 6 months ago, I realized now I can't walk for miles and miles and miles the way I used to. And I always loved doing that, because Paris is a great city for walking.
You've been listening to an interview with Edmund White, whose latest book is Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris, a Memoir. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.